"Come in," the robed and bearded man was saying, and then, "Come in, my son," as Shasta panted up to him. He heard the gate closed behind him, and the bearded stranger was already helping Alavis off her horse. They were in a wide and perfectly circular enclosure, protected by a high wall of green turf. A pool of perfectly still water, so full that the water was almost exactly level with the ground, lay before him. At one end of the pool, completely overshadowing it with its branches, there grew the hugest and most beautiful tree that Shasta had ever seen. Beyond the pool was a little low house of stone, roofed with deep and ancient thatch. There was a sound of bleating, and over at the far side of the enclosure there were some goats. The level ground was completely covered with the finest grass.
Are you, panted Chester, "are you King Loon of Arkenland?"
The old man shook his head.
"No,"
he replied in a quiet voice.
"I am the hermit of the Southern March. And now, my son, waste no time on questions, but obey. This damsel is wounded. Your horses are spent. Rabadash is at this moment finding a ford over the Winding Arrow. If you run now without a moment's rest, you will still be in time to warn King Loon."
Shasta's heart fainted at these words, for he felt he had no strength left, and he writhed inside at what seemed the cruelty and unfairness of the demand. He had not yet learned that if you do one good deed, your reward usually is to be set to do another and harder and better one. But all he said out loud was,
"Where is the king?"
The hermit turned and pointed with his staff.
"Look," he said, "there is another gate right opposite to the one you entered by. Open it and go straight ahead, always straight ahead, over level or steep, over smooth or rough, over dry or wet. I know by my art that you will find King Loon straight ahead. But run, run, always run!"
Shasta nodded his head, ran to the northern gate, and disappeared beyond it. Then the hermit took Aravis, whom he had all this time been supporting with his left arm, and half led, half carried her into the house. After a long time he came out again.
"Now, cousins," he said to the horses, "it is your turn."
Without waiting for an answer, and indeed they were too exhausted to speak, he took the bridles and saddles off both of them. Then he rubbed them both down so well that a groom in a king's stable would not have done it better.
"There, cousins," he said, "dismiss it all from your minds and be comforted. Here is water, and there is grass. You shall have a hot mash when I have milked my other cousins, the goats."
"Sir,"
said Huynh, finding her voice at last,
"will the Tarquina live? Has the lion killed her?"
"I, who know many present things by my art," replied the hermit with a smile, "have yet little knowledge of things future. Therefore I do not know whether any man or woman or beast in the whole world will be alive when the sun sets to-night. But be of good hope. The damsel is likely to live as long as any of her age."
When Alavis came to herself, she found that she was lying on her face on a low bed of extraordinary softness, in a cool, bare room with walls of undressed stone. She couldn't understand why she had been laid on her face. But when she tried to turn and felt the hot, burning pains all over her back, she remembered and realized why. She couldn't understand what delightfully springy stuff the bed was made of, because it was made of heather, which is the best bedding, and heather was a thing she had never seen or heard of. The door opened, and the hermit entered, carrying a large wooden bowl in his hand. After carefully setting this down, he came to the bedside and asked,
"How do you find yourself, my daughter?"
"My back is very sore, father,"
said Aravis,
"but there is nothing else wrong with me."
He knelt beside her, laid his hand on her forehead, and felt her pulse.
"There is no fever," he said. "You will do well. Indeed, there is no reason why you should not get up tomorrow. But now, drink this."
He fetched the wooden bowl and held it to her lips. Aravis couldn't help making a face when she tasted it, for goat's milk is rather a shock when you are not used to it. But she was very thirsty, and managed to drink it all, and felt better when she had finished.
"Now, my daughter, you may sleep when you wish," said the hermit. for your wounds are washed and dressed, and though they smart, they are no more serious than if they had been the cuts of a whip. You must have been a very strange lion, for instead of catching you out of the saddle and getting his teeth into you, he has only drawn his claws across your back. 10 scratches. Sore, but not deep or dangerous.
I say, said Aravis, I have had luck.
Daughter, said the hermit, I have now lived 109 winters in this world, and have never yet met any such thing as luck. There is something about all this that I do not understand, but if ever we need to know it, you may be sure that we shall.
And what about Rabadash and his 200 horse?
Asked Aravis.
They will not pass this way, I think, said the hermit. They must have found a ford by now, well to the east of us. From there they will try to ride straight to Anvard.
Poor Shasta, said Aravis. Has he far to go? Will he get there first?
There is good hope of it, said the old man.
Aravis lay down again, on her side this time, and said,
Have I been asleep for a long time? It seems to be getting dark.
The hermit was looking out of the only window, which faced north.
This is not the darkness of night, he said presently. The clouds are falling down from Stormness Head. Our foul weather always comes from there in these parts. There will be thick fog tonight.
Next day, except for her sore back, Aravis felt so well that after breakfast, which was porridge and cream, the hermit said she could get up. And of course she at once went out to speak to the horses. The weather had changed, and the whole of that green enclosure was filled like a great green cup with sunlight. It was a very peaceful place, lonely and quiet. Fwyn at once trotted across to Aravis and gave her a horse kiss.
"But where's Bree?"
said Aravis, when each had asked after the other's health and sleep.
"Over there,"
said Fwyn, pointing with her nose to the far side of the circle.
"And I wish you'd come and talk to him. There's something wrong. I can't get a word out of him."
They strolled across and found Bree lying with his face toward the wall, and though he must have heard them coming, he never turned his head or spoke a word.
"Good morning, Bree," said Aravis. "How are you this morning?"
Bree muttered something that no one could hear. "The hermit says that Shasta probably got to King Lun in time," continued Aravis. "So it looks as if all our troubles are over.
Narnia at last, Bree."
"I shall never see Narnia," said Bree in a low voice.
"Aren't you well, Bree, dear?"
said Aravis. Bree turned round at last, his face mournful as only a horse's can be.
"I shall go back to Kolormen," he said.
"What?" said Aravis. "Back to slavery?"
"Yes," said Bree. "Slavery is all I'm fit for. How can I ever show my face among the free horses of Narnia? I, who left a mare and a girl and a boy to be eaten by lions, while I galloped all I could to save my own wretched skin."
"We all ran as hard as we could," said Fwyn.
"Shasta didn't," snorted Bree. "At least he ran in the right direction. Ran back. And that is what shames me most of all. I, who called myself a warhorse and boasted of 100 fights, to be beaten by a little human boy, a child, a mere foal, who had never held a sword nor had any good nurture or example in his life."
"I know," said Aravis. "I felt just the same. Shasta was marvellous. I'm just as bad as you, Bree. I've been snubbing him and looking down on him ever since you met us, and now he turns out to be the best of us all. But I think it would be better to stay and say we're sorry than to go back to Kalorman."
"It's all very well for you," said Bree. "You haven't disgraced yourself. But I've lost everything." "My good horse,"
said the hermit, who had approached them unnoticed because his bare feet made so little noise on that sweet, dewy grass.
"My good horse, you've lost nothing but your self-conceit." "No, no, cousin. Don't put back your ears and shake your mane at me. If you are really so humbled as you sounded a minute ago, you must learn to listen to sense. You're not quite the great horse you had come to think, from living among poor, dumb horses. Of course you were braver and cleverer than them. You could hardly help being that. It doesn't follow that you'll be anyone very special in Narnia. But as long as you know you're nobody special, you'll be a very decent sort of horse on the whole, and taking one thing with another. And now, if you and my other four-footed cousin will come round to the kitchen door, we'll see about the other half of that mash.
Chapter 11. The Unwelcome Fellow Traveller. When Shasta went through the gate, he found a slope of grass and a little heather running up before him to some trees. He had nothing to think about now and no plans to make. He had only to run, and that was quite enough. His limbs were shaking, a terrible stitch was beginning in his side, and the sweat that kept dropping into his eyes blinded them and made them smart. He was unsteady on his feet, too, and more than once he nearly turned his ankle on a loose stone. The trees were thicker now than they had yet been, and in the more open spaces there was bracken. The sun had gone in without making it any cooler. It had become one of those hot, grey days when there seemed to be twice as many flies as usual. Shasta's face was covered with them. He didn't even try to shake them off. He had too much else to do. Suddenly, he heard a horn. Not a great throbbing horn like the horns of Tashban, but a merry call. Tiro to to ho! Next moment he came out into a wide glade and found himself in a crowd of people. At least it looked a crowd to him. In reality, there were about 15 or 20 of them, all gentlemen in green hunting dress, with their horses. Some in the saddle and some standing by their horses' heads. In the centre, someone was holding the stirrup for a man to mount, and the man he was holding it for was the jolliest, fattest, most apple-cheeked, twinkling-eyed king you could imagine. As soon as Shasta came in sight, this king forgot all about mounting his horse. He spread out his arms to Shasta, his face lit up, and he cried out in a great deep voice that seemed to come from the bottom of his chest,
"Corin, my son, and on foot and in rags! What the—"
"No," panted Shasta, shaking his head, "not Prince Corin. I know I'm like him. Saw his highness in Tashban. Send his greetings."
The king was staring at Shasta with an extraordinary expression on his face.
"Are you King Loon?"
gasped Shasta. And then, without waiting for an answer,
"Lord, King, fly! Anvar, shut the gates! Enemies upon you! Rabadash and 200 horse!"
"Have you assurance of this, boy?" asked one of the other gentlemen.
"My own eyes," said Shasta. "I've seen them. Raced them all the way from Tashban."
"On foot?" said the gentleman, raising his eyebrows a little.
"Horses, with the hermit," said Shasta.
"Question him no more, Darin," said King Loon. "I see truth in his face. We must ride for it, gentlemen. A spare horse there for the boy. You can ride fast, friend."
For answer, Shasta put his foot in the stirrup of the horse which had been led toward him, and a moment later he was in the saddle. He had done it 100 times with Bree in the last few weeks, and his mounting was very different now from what it had been on that first night when Bree had said that he climbed up a horse as if he were climbing a haystack. He was pleased to hear the Lord Darin say to the king,
"The boy has a true horseman's seat, sire. I warrant there's noble blood in him." "His blood? Aye. There's the point," said the king.
And he stared hard at Shasta again with that curious expression, almost a hungry expression, in his steady grey eyes. But by now the whole party was moving off at a brisk canter. Shasta's seat was excellent, but he was sadly puzzled as to what to do with his reins, for he had never touched the reins while he was on Bree's back. But he looked very carefully out of the corners of his eyes to see what the others were doing, as some of us have done at parties when we weren't quite sure which knife or fork we were meant to use, and tried to get his fingers right. But he didn't dare to try really directing the horse. He trusted it would follow the rest. The horse was, of course, an ordinary horse, not a talking horse. But it had quite wits enough to realise that the strange boy on its back had no whip and no spurs, and was not really master of the situation. That was why Shasta soon found himself at the tail end of the procession. Even so, he was going pretty fast. There were no flies now, and the air in his face was delicious. He had got his breath back, too, and his errand had succeeded. For the first time since the arrival at Tashban, how long ago it seemed, he was beginning to enjoy himself. He looked up to see how much nearer the mountain tops had come.
To his disappointment, he could not see them at all, only a vague greyness rolling down toward them. He had never been in mountain country before, and was surprised.
"It's a cloud," he said to himself. "A cloud coming down. I see. Up here in the hills, one is really in the sky. I shall see what the inside of a cloud is like. What fun! I've often wondered."
Far away on his left, and a little behind him, the sun was getting ready to set. They had come to a rough kind of road by now, and were making very good speed. But Shasta's horse was still the last of the lot. Once or twice, when the road made a bend, there was now continuous forest on each side of it, he lost sight of the others for a second or two. Then they plunged into the fog, or else the fog rolled over them. The world became grey. Shasta had not realized how cold and wet the inside of a cloud would be, nor how dark. The grey turned to black with alarming speed. Someone at the head of the column winded the horn every now and then, and each time the sound came from a little farther off. He couldn't see any of the others now, but of course he'd be able to as soon as he got round the next bend. But when he rounded it, he still couldn't see them. In fact, he could see nothing at all. His horse was walking now.
"Get on, horse, get on," said Shasta.
Then came the horn, very faint. Bree had always told him that he must keep his heels well turned out, and Shasta had got the idea that something very terrible would happen if he dug his heels into a horse's sides. This seemed to him an occasion for trying it.
"Look here, horse," he said. "If you don't buck up, do you know what I'll do? I'll dig my heels into you. I really will."
The horse, however, took no notice of this threat. So Shasta settled himself firmly in the saddle, gripped with his knees, clenched his teeth, and punched both the horse's sides with his heels as hard as he could. The only result was that the horse broke into a kind of pretense of a trot for 5 or 6 paces, and then subsided into a walk again. And now it was quite dark, and they seemed to have given up blowing that horn. The only sound was a steady drip-drip from the branches of the trees.
"Well, I suppose even a walk will get us somewhere sometime," said Shasta to himself. "I only hope I shan't run into Rabbitash and his people."
He went on for what seemed a long time, always at a walking pace. He began to hate that horse, and he was also beginning to feel very hungry. Presently he came to a place where the road divided into two. He was just wondering which led to Anvard when he was startled by a noise from behind him. It was the noise of trotting horses.
"Rabbitash," thought Shasta.
He had no way of guessing which road Rabbitash would take.
"But if I take one," said Shasta to himself, "he may take the other, and if I stay at the crossroads, I'm sure to be caught."
He dismounted and led his horse as quickly as he could along the right-hand road. The sound of the cavalry grew rapidly nearer, and in a minute or two Shasta realized that they were at the crossroads. He held his breath, waiting to see which way they would take. There came a low word of command, "Halt!" Then a moment of horsey noises, nostrils blowing, hoofs pawing, bits being champed, necks being patted. Then a voice spoke.
"Attend, all of you," it said. "We are now within a furlong of the castle. Remember your orders. Once we are in Narnia, as we should be by sunrise, you are to kill as little as possible. On this venture you are to regard every drop of Narnian blood as more precious than a gallon of your own. On this venture, I say. The gods will send us a happier hour, and then you must leave nothing alive between Caer Paravel and the Western Waste. But we are not yet in Narnia. Here in Achenland it is another thing. In the assault on this castle of King Loon's, nothing matters but speed. Show your mettle. It must be mine within an hour. And if it is, I give it all to you. I reserve no booty for myself. Kill me every barbarian male within its walls, down to the child that was born yesterday, and everything else is yours to divide as you please. The women, the gold, the jewels, the weapons, and the wine. The man that I see hanging back when we come to the gates shall be burned alive. In the name of Tash the Irresistible, the Inexorable, forward!"
With a great cloppity-clop, the column began to move, and Shasta breathed again. They had taken the other road. Shasta thought they took a long time going past, for though he had been talking and thinking about 200 horse all day, he had not realized how many they really were. But at last the sound died away, and once more he was alone amid the drip-drip from the trees. He now knew the way to Anvard, but of course he could not now go there. That would only mean running into the arms of Rabadash's troopers.
"What on earth am I to do?"
said Shasta to himself. But he remounted his horse and continued along the road he had chosen, in the faint hope of finding some cottage where he might ask for shelter and a meal. He had thought, of course, of going back to Aravis and Bree and Huyn at the Hermitage, but he couldn't, because by now he had not the least idea of the direction.
"After all," said Shasta, "this road is bound to get somewhere."
But that all depends on what you mean by somewhere. The road kept on getting to somewhere, in the sense that it got to more and more trees, all dark and dripping, and to colder and colder air. And strange, icy winds kept blowing the mist past him, though they never blew it away. If he had been used to mountain country, he would have realized that this meant he was now very high up, perhaps right at the top of the pass. But Shasta knew nothing about mountains.
"I do think," said Shasta, "that I must be the most unfortunate boy that ever lived in the whole world. Everything goes right for everyone except me. Those Narnian lords and ladies got safe away from Tashban. I was left behind. Aravis and Bree and Huyn are all as snug as anything with that old hermit. Of course I was the one who was sent on. King Lune and his people must have got safely into the castle and shut the gates long before Rabadash arrived. But I get left out."
And being very tired and having nothing inside him, he felt so sorry for himself that the tears rolled down his cheeks. What put a stop to all this was a sudden fright. Shasta discovered that someone, or somebody, was walking beside him. It was pitch dark, and he could see nothing, and the thing, or person, was going so quietly that he could hardly hear any footfalls. What he could hear was breathing. His invisible companion seemed to breathe on a very large scale, and Shasta got the impression that it was a very large creature. And he had come to notice this breathing so gradually that he had really no idea how long it had been there. It was a horrible shock. It darted into his mind that he had heard long ago that there were giants in these northern countries. He bit his lip in terror. But now that he really had something to cry about, he stopped crying. The thing, unless it was a person, went on beside him so very quietly that Shasta began to hope he had only imagined it. But just as he was becoming quite sure of it, there suddenly came a deep, rich sigh out of the darkness beside him. That couldn't be imagination. Anyway, he had felt the hot breath of that sigh on his chilly left hand. If the horse had been any good, or if he had known how to get any good out of the horse, he would have risked everything on a breakaway and a wild gallop. But he knew he couldn't make that horse gallop. So he went on at a walking pace, and the unseen companion walked and breathed beside him. At last he could bear it no longer.
"Who are you?"
he said, scarcely above a whisper.
"One who has waited long for you to speak," said the thing.
Its voice was not loud, but very large and deep.
Are you a giant?"
asked Shasta.
"You might call me a giant," said the large voice. "But I am not like the creatures you call giants."
"I can't see you at all,"
said Shasta, after staring very hard. Then, for an even more terrible idea had come into his head, he said, almost in a scream,
"You're not something dead, are you? Oh, please, please do go away. What harm have I ever done you? Oh, I am the unluckiest person in the whole world."
Once more he felt the warm breath of the thing on his hand and face.
"There," it said, "that is not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows."
Shasta was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his real father or mother, and had been brought up sternly by the fishermen. And then he told the story of his escape, and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives, and of all their dangers in Tashban, and about his night among the tombs, and how the beasts howled at him out of the desert. And he told about the heat and thirst of their desert journey, and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them and wounded Alavis, and also how very long it was since he had had anything to eat.
"I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice.
"Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?"
said Shasta.
"There was only one lion," said the voice.
"What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were at least two the first night, and—"
"There was only one, but he was swift of foot."
"How do you know?"
"I was the lion."
And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued,
"I was the lion who forced you to join with Aravis. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile, so that you should reach King Loon in time. And I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that it came to shore where a man sat, wakeful at midnight, to receive you."
"Then it was you who wounded Aravis?"
"It was I."
"But what for?"
"Child," said the voice, "I am telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own."
"Who are you?"
asked Shasta.
"Myself,"
said the voice, very deep and low, so that the earth shook. And again, "Myself," loud and clear and gay. And then the third time,
"Myself,"
whispered so softly you could hardly hear it, and yet it seemed to come from all round you, as if the leaves rustled with it. Shasta was no longer afraid that the voice belonged to something that would eat him, nor that it was the voice of a ghost. But a new and different sort of trembling came over him, yet he felt glad, too. The mist was turning from black to grey and from grey to white. This must have begun to happen some time ago, but while he had been talking to the thing, he had not been noticing anything else. Now the whiteness around him became a shining whiteness. His eyes began to blink. Somewhere ahead he could hear birds singing. He knew the night was over at last. He could see the mane and ears and head of his horse quite easily now. A golden light fell on them from the left. He thought it was the sun. He turned and saw, pacing beside him, taller than the horse, a lion. The horse did not seem to be afraid of it, or else could not see it. It was from the lion that the light came. No one ever saw anything more terrible or beautiful. Luckily, Shasta had lived all his life too far south in Kalorman to have heard the tales that were whispered in Tashban about a dreadful Narnian demon that appeared in the form of a lion. And of course he knew none of the true stories about Aslan, the great lion, the son of the Emperor over the sea, the king above all high kings in Narnia. But after one glance at the lion's face, he slipped out of the saddle and fell at its feet. He couldn't say anything, but then he didn't want to say anything, and he knew he needn't say anything. The high king above all kings stooped toward him. Its mane, and some strange and solemn perfume that hung about the mane, was all round him. It touched his forehead with its tongue. He lifted his face, and their eyes met. Then instantly, the pale brightness of the mist and the fiery brightness of the lion rolled themselves together into a swirling glory and gathered themselves up and disappeared. He was alone with the horse on a grassy hillside under a blue sky, and there were birds singing. Chapter 12. Shasta in Narnia.
"Was it all a dream?"
wondered Shasta. But it couldn't have been a dream, for there in the grass before him he saw the deep, large print of the lion's front right paw. It took one's breath away to think of the weight that could make a footprint like that. But there was something more remarkable than the size about it. As he looked at it, water had already filled the bottom of it. Soon it was full to the brim, and then overflowing, and the little stream was running downhill past him, over the grass. Shasta stooped and drank a very long drink, and then dipped his face in and splashed his head.
It was extremely cold and clear as glass, and refreshed him very much. After that, he stood up, shaking the water out of his ears and flinging the wet hair back from his forehead, and began to take stock of his surroundings. Apparently it was still very early morning. The sun had only just risen, and it had risen out of the forests which he saw low down and far away on his right. The country which he was looking at was absolutely new to him. It was a green valley land dotted with trees, through which he caught the gleam of a river that wound away roughly to the northwest. On the far side of the valley there were high and even rocky hills, but they were lower than the mountains he had seen yesterday. Then he began to guess where he was. He turned and looked behind him, and saw that the slope on which he was standing belonged to a range of far higher mountains.
"I see," said Shasta to himself. "Those are the big mountains between Arkenland and Narnia. I was on the other side of them yesterday. I must have come through the pass in the night. What luck that I hit it. And it wasn't luck at all, really. It was him. And now I'm in Narnia."
He turned and unsaddled his horse, and took off its bridle.
"Though you are a perfectly horrid horse," he said.
It took no notice of this remark, and immediately began eating grass. That horse had a very low opinion of Shasta.
"I wish I could eat grass," thought Shasta. "It's no good going back to Anvard. It'll all be besieged. I'd better get lower down into the valley and see if I can get anything to eat."
So he went on downhill. The thick dew was cruelly cold to his bare feet, till he came into a wood. There was a kind of track running through it, and he had not followed this for many minutes when he heard a thick and rather wheezy voice saying to him,
"Good morning, neighbour."
Shasta looked round eagerly to find the speaker, and presently saw a small, prickly person with a dark face who had just come out from among the trees. At least it was small for a person, but very big indeed for a hedgehog, which was what it was.
"Good morning," said Shasta, "but I'm not a neighbour. In fact, I'm a stranger in these parts."
"Ah," said the hedgehog, inquiringly.
"I've come over the mountains, from Arkenland, you know."
"Ah, Arkenland," said the hedgehog. "That's a terrible long way. Never been there myself."
"And I think, perhaps," said Shasta, "someone ought to be told that there's an army of savage Calormenes attacking Anvard at this very moment."
"You don't say so," answered the hedgehog. "Well, think of that. And they do say that Calormen is hundreds and thousands of miles away, right at the world's end, across a great sea of sand."
"It's not nearly as far as you think," said Shasta. "And oughtn't something to be done about this attack on Anvard? Oughtn't your High King to be told?"
"Certain sure something ought to be done about it," said the hedgehog. "But you see, I'm just on my way to bed for a good day's sleep. Hello, neighbour."
The last words were addressed to an immense biscuit-coloured rabbit, whose head had just popped up from somewhere beside the path. The hedgehog immediately told the rabbit what it had just learned from Shasta. The rabbit agreed that this was very remarkable news, and that somebody ought to tell someone about it with a view to doing something. And so it went on. Every few minutes they were joined by other creatures, some from the branches overhead and some from little underground houses at their feet, till the party consisted of 5 rabbits, a squirrel, 2 magpies, a goat-foot fawn, and a mouse, who all talked at the same time and all agreed with the hedgehog. For the truth was that in that golden age when the witch and the winter had gone, and Peter the High King ruled at Caer Paravel, the smaller woodland people of Narnia were so safe and happy that they were getting a little careless. Presently, however, 2 more practical people arrived in the little wood. One was a red dwarf, whose name appeared to be Duffel. The other was a stag, a beautiful lordly creature with wide liquid eyes, dappled flanks and legs so thin and graceful that they looked as if you could break them with 2 fingers.
"Lion alive!"
roared the dwarf as soon as he had heard the news.
"And if that's so, why are we all standing still, chattering? Enemies at Anvard! News must be sent to Caer Paravel at once. The army must be called out. Narnia must go to the aid of King Loon."
"Ah," said the hedgehog, "but you won't find a High King at the Caer. He's away to the north, trouncing those giants. And talking of giants, neighbours, that puts me in mind—"
"Who'll take our message?" interrupted the dwarf. "Anyone here got more speed than me?"
"I've got speed," said the stag. "What's my message? How many Calormenes?"
200, under Prince Rabidash, and—"
But the stag was already away. All four legs off the ground at once, and in a moment its white stern had disappeared among the remoter trees.
"Wonder where he's going," said a rabbit. "He won't find the High King at Caer Paravel, you know."
"He'll find Queen Lucy," said Duffel, "and then... Hello? What's wrong with a human? Looks pretty green. Why, I do believe it's quite faint. Perhaps it's mortal hungry. When did you last have a meal, youngster?"
"Yesterday morning," said Shasta weakly.
"Come on, then, come on,"
said the dwarf, at once throwing his thick little arms round Shasta's waist to support him.
"Why, neighbours, we all ought to be ashamed of ourselves. You come with me, lad. Breakfast, better than talking."
With a great deal of bustle, muttering reproaches to itself, the dwarf half-led and half-supported Shasta at great speed further into the wood and a little downhill. It was a longer walk than Shasta wanted at that moment, and his legs had begun to feel very shaky before they came out from the trees onto bare hillside. There they found a little house with a smoking chimney and an open door, and as they came to the doorway, Duffel called out,
"Hey, brothers, a visitor for breakfast!"
And immediately, mixed with a sizzling sound, there came to Shasta a simply delightful smell. It was one he had never smelt in his life before, but I hope you have. It was, in fact, the smell of bacon and eggs and mushrooms all frying in a pan.
"Mind your head, lad,"
said Duffel, a moment too late, for Shasta had already bashed his forehead against the low lintel of the door.
"Now," continued the dwarf, "sit you down. The table's a bit low for you, but then the stool's low too. That's right. And here's porridge, and here's a jug of cream, and here's a spoon."
By the time Shasta had finished his porridge, the dwarf's two brothers, whose names were Rogin and Brickle-Thumb, were putting the dish of bacon and eggs and mushrooms, and the coffee pot and the hot milk, and the toast, on the table. It was all new and wonderful to Shasta, for Calormine food is quite different. He didn't even know what the slices of brown stuff were, for he had never seen toast before. He didn't even know what the yellow soft thing they smeared on the toast was, because in Calormine you nearly always get oil instead of butter. And the house itself was quite different from the dark, frosty, fish-smelling hut of Arshish, and from the pillared and carpeted halls in the palaces of Tashban. The roof was very low, and everything was made of wood, and there was a cuckoo clock and a red and white check tablecloth, and a bowl of wild flowers and little curtains on the thick-paned windows. It was also rather troublesome having to use dwarf cups and plates and knives and forks. This meant that helpings were very small, but then there were a great many helpings, so that Shasta's plate or cup was being filled every moment. And every moment the dwarfs themselves were saying,
"Butter, please," or "Another cup of coffee," or "I'd like a few more mushrooms," or "What about frying another egg or so?"
And when at last they had all eaten as much as they possibly could, the three dwarfs drew lots for who would do the washing up, and Rogin was the unlucky one. Then Duffel and Brickle-Thumb took Shasta outside to a bench which ran against the cottage wall, and they all stretched out their legs and gave a great sigh of contentment, and the two dwarfs lit their pipes. The dew was off the grass now, and the sun was warm. Indeed, if there hadn't been a light breeze, it would have been too hot.
"Now, stranger," said Duffel, "I'll show you the lie of the land. You can see nearly all South Narnia from here, and we're rather proud of the view. Right away on your left, beyond those near hills, you can just see the western mountains. And that round hill away on your right is called the Hill of the Stone Table. Just beyond..."
But at that moment he was interrupted by a snore from Shasta, who, what with his night's journey and his excellent breakfast, had fallen fast asleep. The kindly dwarfs, as soon as they noticed this, began making signs to each other not to wake him, and indeed did so much whispering and nodding and getting up and tiptoeing away that they certainly would have waked him if he had been less tired. He slept pretty well nearly all day, but woke up in time for supper. The beds in that house were all too small for him, but they made him a fine bed of heather on the floor, and he never stirred nor dreamed all night. Next morning they had just finished breakfast when they heard a shrill, exciting sound from outside.
"Trumpets!"
said all the dwarfs, as they and Shasta all came running out. The trumpets sounded again, a new noise to Shasta, not huge and solemn like the horns of Tashban, nor gay and merry like King Loon's hunting horn, but clear and sharp and valiant. The noise was coming from the woods to the east, and soon there was a noise of horse hoofs mixed with it. A moment later the head of the column came into sight. First came the Lord Peredan on a bay horse, carrying the great banner of Narnia, a red lion on a green ground. Shasta knew him at once. Then came three people riding abreast, two on great chargers and one on a pony. The two on the chargers were King Edmund and a fair-haired lady with a very merry face, who wore a helmet and a mail shirt, and carried a bow across her shoulder and a quiver full of arrows at her side.
"The Queen Lucy,"
whispered Duffel. But the one on the pony was Corin. After that came the main body of the army, men on ordinary horses, men on talking horses, who didn't mind being ridden on proper occasions, as when Narnia went to war, centaurs, stern, hard-bitten bears, great talking dogs, and last of all, six giants. For there are good giants in Narnia, but though he knew they were on the right side, Shasta at first could hardly bear to look at them. There are some things that take a lot of getting used to. Just as the king and queen reached the cottage, and the dwarfs began making low bows to them, King Edmund called out, "Now, friends, time for a halt and a morsel." And at once there was a great bustle of people dismounting and haversacks being opened and conversation beginning, when Corin came running up to Shasta and seized both his hands and cried,
"What? You here? So you got through all right? I am glad. Now we shall have some sport. And isn't it luck? We only got into the harbour at Caer Paravel yesterday morning, and the very first person who met us was Chervy the Stag with all this news of an attack on Anvard. Don't you think—"
"Who is your Highness's friend?" said King Edmund, who had just got off his horse.
"Don't you see, sire?" said Corin. "It's my double, the boy you mistook me for at Tashbarn."
"Why, so he is your double," exclaimed Queen Lucy, "as like as two twins. This is a marvellous thing." "Please, your Majesty," said Shasta to King Edmund, "I was no traitor. Really, I wasn't. And I couldn't help hearing your plans. But I'd never have dreamed of telling them to your enemies."
"I know now that you were no traitor, boy," said King Edmund, laying his hand on Shasta's head. "But if you would not be taken for one, another time try not to hear what's meant for other ears. But all's well." After that there was so much bustle and talk and coming and going, the Shasta for a few minutes lost sight of Corin and Edmund and Lucy. But Corin was the sort of boy whom one is sure to hear of pretty soon, and it wasn't very long before Shasta heard King Edmund saying in a loud voice, "By the lion's mane, Prince, this is too much. Will your Highness never be better? You are more of a heart scald than our whole army together. I'd as lief have a regiment of hornets in my command as you." Shasta wormed his way through the crowd, and there saw Edmund looking very angry indeed, Corin looking a little ashamed of himself, and a strange dwarf sitting on the ground making faces. A couple of fawns had apparently just been helping it out of its armour.
"If I had but my cordial with me," Queen Lucy was saying, "I could soon mend this. But the High King has so strictly charged me not to carry it commonly to the wars, and to keep it only for great extremities."
What had happened was this. As soon as Corin had spoken to Shasta, Corin's elbow had been plucked by a dwarf in the army called Thornbutt.
"What is it, Thornbutt?"
Corin had said.
"Your Royal Highness," said Thornbutt, drawing him aside. "Our march today will bring us through the pass and right to your royal father's castle. We may be in battle before night."
"I know," said Corin. "Isn't it splendid?"
"Splendid or not," said Thornbutt, "I have the strictest orders from King Edmund to see to it that your Highness is not in the fight. You'll be allowed to see it, and that's treat enough for your Highness's little years."
"Oh, what nonsense!" Corin burst out. "Of course I'm going to fight. Why, the Queen Lucy's going to be with the archers."
"The Queen's Grace will do as she pleases," said Thornbutt, "but you are in my charge. Either I must have your solemn and princely word that you'll keep your pony beside mine, not half a neck ahead, till I give your Highness leave to depart, or else, it is His Majesty's word, we must go with our wrists tight together like two prisoners."
"I'll knock you down if you try to bind me," said Corin.
"I'd like to see your Highness do it," said the dwarf.
That was quite enough for a boy like Corin, and in a second he and the dwarf were at it hammer and tongs. It would have been an even match, for though Corin had longer arms and more height, the dwarf was older and tougher. But it was never fought out. That's the worst of fights on a rough hillside. For by very bad luck, Thornbutt trod on a loose stone, came flat down on his nose, and found when he tried to get up that he had sprained his ankle. A really excruciating sprain, which would keep him from walking or riding for at least a fortnight.
"See what your Highness has done," said King Edmund, "deprived us of a proved warrior on the very edge of battle."
"I'll take his place, sire," said Corin.
"Pshaw," said Edmund, "no one doubts your courage,
but a boy in battle is a danger only to his own side. At that moment, the king was called away to attend to something else, and Corin, after apologizing handsomely to the dwarf, rushed up to Shasta and whispered,
"Quick, there's a spare pony now, and the dwarf's armor. Put it on before anyone notices."
"What for?" said Shasta.
"Why, so that you and I can fight in a battle, of course. Don't you want to?"
Yes, of course," said Shasta.
But he hadn't been thinking of doing so at all, and began to get a most uncomfortable prickly feeling in his spine.
"That's right," said Corin. "Over your head. Now the sword belt. But we must ride near the tail of the column and keep as quiet as mice. Once the battle begins, everyone will be far too busy to notice us."
Chapter 13. The Fight at Anvard. By about 11 o'clock, the whole company was once more on the march, riding westward with the mountains on their left. Corin and Shasta rode right at the rear with the giants immediately in front of them. Lucy and Edmund and Peridan were busy with their plans for the battle, and though Lucy once said, "But where is his goose-cap highness?" Edmund only replied, "Not in the front, and that's good news. Leave well alone." Shasta told Corin most of his adventures, and explained that he had learned all his riding from a horse, and didn't really know how to use the reins. Corin instructed him in this, besides telling him all about their secret sailing from Tashban.
"And where is the Queen Susan?"
"At Caer Paravel," said Corin. "She's not like Lucy, you know, who's as good as a man, or at any rate as good as a boy. Queen Susan is more like an ordinary grown-up lady. She doesn't ride to the wars, though she's an excellent archer."
The hillside path which they were following became narrower all the time, and the drop on their right hand became steeper. At last they were going in single file along the edge of the precipice, and Shasta shuddered to think that he had done the same last night without knowing it.
"But of course," he thought, "I was quite safe. That is why the lion kept on my left. He was between me and the edge all the time."
Then the path went left and south away from the cliff, and there were thick woods on both sides of it, and they went steeply up and up into the pass. There would have been a splendid view from the top if it were open ground, but among all those trees you could see nothing, only every now and then some huge pinnacle of rock above the treetops, and an eagle or two wheeling high up in the blue air.
"They smell battle," said Corin, pointing at the birds. "They know we're preparing a feed for them."
Shasta didn't like this at all. When they had crossed the neck of the pass and come a good deal lower, they reached more open ground, and from here Shasta could see all Arkenland, blue and hazy, spread out below him, and even, he thought, a hint of the desert beyond it. But the sun, which had perhaps 2 hours or so to go before it set, was in his eyes, and he couldn't make things out distinctly. Here the army halted and spread out in a line, and there was a great deal of rearranging. A whole detachment of very dangerous-looking talking beasts, whom Shasta had not noticed before and who were mostly of the cat kind, leopards, panthers and the like, went padding and growling to take up their positions on the left. The giants were ordered to the right, and before going there they all took off something they'd been carrying on their backs and sat down for a moment. Then Shasta saw that what they had been carrying and were now putting on were pairs of boots, horrid, heavy, spiked boots which came up to their knees. Then they sloped their huge clubs over their shoulders and marched to their battle position. The archers, with Queen Lucy, fell to the rear, and you could first see them bending their bows and then hear the twang-twang as they tested the strings. And wherever you looked, you could see people tightening girths, putting on helmets, drawing swords, and throwing cloaks at the ground. There was hardly any talking now. It was very solemn and very dreadful.
"I'm in for it now. I really am in for it now," thought Shasta.
Then there came noises far ahead, the sound of many men shouting, and a steady thud, thud, thud.
"Battering ram," whispered Corin. "They're battering the gate."
Even Corin looked quite serious now.
"Why doesn't King Edmund get on?" he said. "I can't stand this waiting about. It's chilly, too."
Shasta nodded, hoping he didn't look as frightened as he felt.
The trumpet, at last. On the move now, now trotting, the banner streaming out in the wind. They had topped a low ridge now, and below them the whole scene suddenly opened out, a little many-towered castle with its gate toward them. No moat, unfortunately, but of course the gate shut and the portcullis down. On the walls they could see, like little white dots, the faces of the defenders. Down below, About 50 of the Colormines, dismounted, were steadily swinging a great tree trunk against the gate. But at once the scene changed. The main bulk of Rabadash's men had been on foot ready to assault the gate. But now he had seen the Narnians sweeping down from the ridge. There is no doubt those Colormines are wonderfully trained. It seemed to Shasta only a second before a whole line of the enemy were on horseback again, wheeling round to meet them, swinging toward them. And now a gallop. The ground between the two armies grew less every moment. Faster, faster. All swords out now, all shields up to the nose, all prayers said, all teeth clenched. Shasta was dreadfully frightened. But it suddenly came into his head, "If you funk this, you'll funk every battle all your life. Now or never." And when at last the two lines met, he had really very little idea of what happened. There was a frightful confusion and an appalling noise. His sword was knocked clean out of his hand pretty soon, and he got the reins tangled somehow. Then he found himself slipping. Then a spear came straight at him, and as he ducked to avoid it, he rolled right off his horse, bashed his left knuckles terribly against someone else's armour, and then... But it is no use trying to describe the battle from Shasta's point of view. He understood too little of the fight in general, and even of his own part in it. The best way I can tell you what really happened is to take you some miles away to where the Hermit of the Southern March sat gazing into the smooth pool beneath the spreading tree, with Bri and Huynh and Aravis beside him. For it was in this pool that the hermit looked when he wanted to know what was going on in the world outside the green walls of his hermitage. There, as in a mirror, he could see, at certain times, what was going on in the streets of cities far farther south than Tashban, or what ships were putting into Redhaven in the remote Seven Isles, or what robbers or wild beasts stirred in the great western forests between Lantern Waste and Telmar. And all this day he had hardly left his pool, even to eat or drink, for he knew that great events were afoot in Arkenland. Aravis and the horses gazed into it too. They could see it was a magic pool. Instead of reflecting the tree and the sky, it revealed cloudy and coloured shapes moving, always moving in its depths. But they could see nothing clearly. The hermit could, and from time to time he told them what he saw. A little while before Shasta rode into his first battle, the hermit had begun speaking like this.
"I see 1, 2, 3 eagles wheeling in the gap by Stormness Head. One is the oldest of all the eagles. He would not be out unless battle was at hand. I see him wheel to and fro, peering down sometimes at Anvard, and sometimes to the east, behind Stormness. Ah, I see now what Rabadash and his men have been so busy at all day. They have felled and lopped a great tree, and they are now coming out of the woods carrying it as a ram. They have learned something from the failure of last night's assault. He would have been wiser if he had set his men to making ladders, but it takes too long, and he is impatient, fool that he is. He ought to have ridden back to Tashban as soon as the first attack failed, for his whole plan depended on speed and surprise. Now they are bringing their ram into position. King Loon's men are shooting hard from the walls. 5 Colormines have fallen, but not many will. They have their shields above their heads. Rabadash is giving his orders now. With him are his most trusted lords, fierce Tarkans from the eastern provinces. I can see their faces. There is Coradin of Castle Torment, and Azru, and Clamash, and Ilgamuth of the Twisted Lip, and a tall Tarkan with a crimson beard. By the mane, my old master Anradin, said Bri. Shh, said Aravis. Now the ram has started. If I could hear as well as see, what a noise that would make. Stroke after stroke, and no gate can stand it forever. But wait. Something up by Stormness has scared the birds. They're coming out in masses, and wait again. I can't see yet. Ah, now I can. The whole ridge up on the east is black with horsemen. If only the wind would catch that standard and spread it out. They're over the ridge now, whoever they are. Ah, I've seen the banner now. Narnia, Narnia, it's the Red Lion. They're in full career down the hill now. I can see King Edmund. There's a woman behind among the archers. Oh! What is it? Asked Huynh breathlessly. All his cats are dashing out from the left of the line. Cats? Said Aravis. Great cats, leopards and such, said the hermit impatiently. I see, I see.
The cats are coming round in a circle to get at the horses of the dismounted men. A good stroke. The Calormine horses are mad with terror already. Now the cats are in among them. But Rabadash has reformed his line and has 100 men in the saddle. They're riding to meet the Narnians. There's only 100 yards between the two lines now. Only 50. I can see King Edmund. I can see the Lord Peridan. There are two mere children in the Narnian line. What can the king be about to let them into battle? Only 10 yards. The lines have met. The giants on the Narnian right are doing wonders. But one's down. Shot through the eye, I suppose. The centre's all in a muddle. I can see more on the left. There are the two boys again. Lion alive. One is Prince Corin. The other like him as two peas. It's your little Shasta. Corin is fighting like a man. He's killed a Calormine. I can see a bit of the centre now. Rabadash and Edmund almost met then, but the press has separated them. What about Shasta? Said Aravis. Oh, the fool, groaned the hermit. Poor, brave little fool. He knows nothing about this work. He's making no use at all of his shield. His whole side's exposed. He hasn't the faintest idea what to do with his sword. Oh, he's remembered it now. He's waving it wildly about, nearly cut his own pony's head off, and he will in a moment if he's not careful. It's been knocked out of his hand now. It's mere murder sending a child into the battle. He can't live 5 minutes. Duck, you fool! Oh, he's down.
Killed?
Asked three voices breathlessly.
How can I tell? Said the hermit. Cats have done their work. All the riderless horses are dead or escaped now. No retreat for the Calormines on them. Now the cats are turning back into the main battle. They're leaping on the ram's men. The ram is down. Oh, good. Good! The gates are opening from the inside. There's going to be a sortie. The first three are out. It's King Lune in the middle, the brothers Dar and Darin on each side of him. Behind them are Tran and Shar and Cole with his brother Colin. There are 10, 20, nearly 30 of them out by now. The Calormine line is being forced back upon them. King Edmund is dealing marvellous strokes. He's just slashed Corradin's head off. Lots of Calormines have thrown down their arms and are running for the woods. Those that remain are hard-pressed. The giants are closing in on the right, cats on the left, King Lune from their rear. The Calormines are a little knot now, fighting back to back. Your Tarkhan's down, Bree. Lune and Azru are fighting hand to hand. The king looks like winning. The king is keeping it up well. The king has won. Azru's down. King Edmund's down. No, he's up again. He's at it with Rabadash. They're fighting in the very gates of the castle. Several Calormines have surrendered. Darin has killed Ilgamuth. I can't see what's happened to Rabadash. I think he's dead, leaning against the castle wall, but I don't know. Clamash and King Edmund are still fighting, but the battle is over everywhere else. Clamash has surrendered. The battle is over. The Calormines are utterly defeated.
When Shasta fell off his horse, he gave himself up for lost. But horses, even in battle, tread on human beings very much less than you would suppose. After a very horrible 10 minutes or so, Shasta realized suddenly that there were no longer any horses stamping about in the immediate neighborhood, and that the noise, for there were still a good many noises going on, was no longer that of a battle. He sat up and stared about him. Even he, little as he knew of battles, could soon see that the Arkenlanders and Narnians had won. The only living Calormines he could see were prisoners. The castle gates were wide open, and King Lune and King Edmund were shaking hands across the battering ram. From the circle of lords and warriors around them, there arose a sound of breathless and excited but obviously cheerful conversation. And then, suddenly, it all united and swelled into a great roar of laughter. Shasta picked himself up, feeling uncommonly stiff, and ran toward the sound to see what the joke was. A very curious sight met his eyes. The unfortunate Rabadash appeared to be suspended from the castle walls. His feet, which were about 2 feet from the ground, were kicking wildly. His chain shirt was somehow hitched up so that it was horribly tight under the arms and came halfway over his face. In fact, he looked just as a man looks if you catch him in the very act of getting into a stiff shirt that is a little too small for him. As far as could be made out afterward, and you may be sure the story was well talked over for many a day, what happened was something like this. Early in the battle, one of the giants had made an unsuccessful stamp at Rabadash with his spiked boot,
Unsuccessful because it didn't crush Rabadash, which was what the giant had intended, but not quite useless, because one of the spikes tore the chainmail, just as you or I might tear an ordinary shirt. So Rabadash, by the time he encountered Edmund at the gate,